Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hey, Patty, how are you doing today?
Doing really good. I think I've got a really exciting podcast tonight. It's a cool theme. I was struggling this week, and I had a conversation with my son, Michael, and he kind of put me in the right direction. So I think I got a cool episode for everybody.
I cannot wait then. So I want to go through this part really fast. So we'd like to thank everyone for being with us this time. If you're not subscribed, please consider clicking the subscribe button that's down below. If you are subscribed, we thank you very much for being with us. In the description for this podcast, you'll find links to everything we have, the Facebook groups, the email address, the Patty's blog, Patty's books on Amazon, Buy Me a Coffee. It's all there, folks. Just look. All right.
Yep.
And boy, I'm kind of giddy this tonight because I've gone through way too much coffee today, I think.
That is not a surprise to anybody who knows you, my dear. So, are you ready?
I think I am. In fact, at this point, I'll just shut up and let you you take over at this point.
So, what I ended up deciding to do was Monsters of War.
Monsters of War.
Yes.
Okay.
So, these are really cool, odd stories that I have been collecting off and on from different sources, and I wanted to start sharing them, and I decided that now is the time. So let's just dive into them. They're going to jump all the way from World War II to today. No rhyme or reason in that they're just, I think, a lot of really cool stories, and I kind of told, you know, if there's any kind of rhyme or reason to it, it's that I tried to pick the really creepy ones for toward the end. So, or the creepier ones, to me anyway. So the first one is, this takes place in Afghanistan. It was told by a gentleman who was part of the special forces for the army. And basically the story is this. So he's in the Afghanistan mountains along with a group of other soldiers. Their job was to observe this particular village for a while. They thought that there was a lot of activity, hanky activity going on, and suspicious people coming and going, that kind of stuff. So they were supposed to keep an eye on this particular village and see what they could find out. So, and if it was what they thought it was, what their superiors thought it was, there would be a raid on the village and what have you. So the team goes up. There's only six men. Two of them are to observe the village close to quarters. The other four are supposed to sort of lay back and kind of hang out. So that's how it is. So over the course of several days, this squad of soldiers, they're doing exactly what they're told to do. And they're pretty sure that there's some hanky activity going on. But unfortunately for them, there's technical problems right from the get-go. They lose radio contact because there's this bizarre static that just keeps coming in, and they're wondering what's going on. They come up with theories, everything from somehow the Taliban is jamming them to, is it the magnetic iron in the rocks that's causing it, you know, and they just can't seem to get any kind of communication, consistent communication going. So that's a big issue. Then one night, they've been there a few days, one night just around dusk, they see this dude in a white robe running through the rocks outside the village. And this is suspicious behavior. So they're watching, you know, closely, what is this guy doing? And they're worried now that maybe they've been found out that, you know, they've been compromised in some way. So they decide to pack up and head out and get ready to go. So as they're packing up as quickly as they can, it's a portable post. It takes a couple minutes, you know, and they're getting ready to go. One of them is standing guard watching this guy and his suspicious behavior while the other guys are doing what they can to get ready to get the heck out of there before something bad happens. Their worry is that this dude is a distraction while other people are coming in a different direction. Because, you know, it's pretty obvious he's blatantly running through the area and doesn't seem to be concerned about being seen. And that's got them really, their hackles up really bad. So as they decide to, as they get out of there, they, it's just, it's dark out. They decide now's the time. Let's move, let's move, let's move. They get moving and they're watching this guy and they see this motion in the distance and it's another white figure. And they're watching this and suddenly they realize there's something wrong. It just looks really wrong. Something was off. So they put on the night vision and they're watching and they realize that like suddenly there's a strange change in the atmosphere. Like their hackles went up and there was something different, something wrong. And that's when, and I'm going to read it. That's when the hallucinations happened. That's when it became beyond comprehension. They saw this huge airplane taking off. They heard a low buzzing sound and they heard this yell. And then there was this boom. And the night sky is just filled with air, with this smoke. And the team is spooked. And they're like, what the heck is going on? And they're watching this white figure moving as all this stuff is going on around them. And they're frozen. They're just stopped. Because if they're moving, they're easier target to find. You know, if you're stopped and you're among the rocks, they may not notice you. And they realize the white figure is running through the rocks. I don't mean around the rocks. I mean through the rocks. And when they finally catch what it's doing, it turns its head and its eyes are glowing. Now, I've worked with night vision because whenever you do paranormal investigation, you know, you do some version thereof. And eyes will glow a little bit, but they aren't like glowing so well that you could see 250 yards away that they're glowing. Like if you catch the eyes in the night vision for a few seconds, they'll glow and that's it. This figure just dives into a rock and it disappears. They're now really scared. They have no idea what's going on. They just know there's six of them and God only knows what is out there. Like there was equipment, you know, and people moving and what is, you know, what's going to happen to them? So they're watching this thing melting over through the rocks and he looks directly back at them as though he knows they're watching him. It's completely dark. There's nothing, no lights of any kind now. Everything else has gone away. They've got no lights on for them, so they don't want to be spotted. The plane is gone. Everything's gone. And suddenly the figure, and this is exactly how they describe it. Suddenly the figure picked up one of its limbs and held it in the air, almost as if it was waving. And then the arm melted back into the form, and it wasn't an arm at all. It was just some sort of mass that was meant to look like an arm from a distance. And the guy who's watching this on the night vision says he was just about to ask the other guys if they could see him. Can you still see him? When the figure disappeared. After it disappeared, the team was completely terrified. They had never seen anything like this in their lives. They made their way back to the base. In the distance, they could see lights flickering near the village. They all but forgot about all of this, and they were just completely overwhelmed by what they had seen with that guy. Now, according to the witness, the team moved into the village. A team moved into the village a few days later based upon their testimony and found that the village was completely abandoned. They found men in the area who had seen the lights that night, besides them, who told them about it. But it wasn't completely abandoned. Eventually, they would find corpses. Corpses streaked, ripped to pieces, shredded. Just the sheer amount of blood told them that the general idea was that there were a lot more dead bodies that were missing than were found. there was a ton of blood on the walls of these houses, in, you know, everywhere, and gore, and a few dead bodies. This was actually marked as an official raid, and, you know, when they came in, but it was all, there was nobody to raid. It was all gone. Everything was gone. Just the bodies, these shredded, torn up, looked like they'd been mauled by dogs, bodies. And this guy said, all I can tell you is whatever I saw running through the desert that night, the white figure, it was making up its mind whether it was going after us or the village. And if there were more than one of them, and he's like, I almost have to believe there had to be more than one of them to be able to commit the carnage that we saw. It decided to take the village instead.
So I'm thinking Jin. What are you thinking?
Could be Jin. Mm. But there are a couple other options coming up. And I am going to take a little step back, because we had talked briefly at one point further back in time about the dog-faced people that of ancient times. We had mentioned it. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that, because while I was doing research for this, I came across a really interesting story. So in the past, we had talked about the fact that St. Christopher, according to religious tradition, was one of these dog-faced people, and how they're described as mastiffs, like their heads were those of a mastiff. They had the human body, but heads like a mastiff. And which means big jaws, you know, the whole nine. They looked like a dog. And I'm not talking just dog-like. I'm saying they looked like a dog. And according to the ancient sculptures, wood carvings, and paintings, Christopher, who we now know as Saint Christopher, was always depicted as a dog person. And it goes all the way back to the 6th century AD. And the Lombards, who supposedly fought the dog-faced people of this island, and they were supposedly confronted an overwhelming tribal army who had these massive numbers of people. The leader of the Lombards thought that there was a plan, and that they were that these dog-faced people were going to savage these, you know, they were sent ahead of the rest of the masses to savage these soldiers. And he writes about how these dog-headed beast men were unyielding in warfare. They drank human blood. They cannibalized the people they killed, and that no army could stand against them. And he talks about, and like I said, this isn't just talk. There are sketches, there is artwork, there are wood carvings. There are all kinds of historical documents and things that show this. So there was an island where these men supposedly lived, and they were known as the Cynocephales, is what their technical term was. That's what they called themselves, the Cynocephales. And they were able to hunt, and they lived together. They did not speak English or any language we know of, but they barked and communicated through a series of howls and barks. Now, if you go back even further, 400 BC, there is a Greek physician and historian who wrote about this. This is what he wrote, which his writing still exists to this day. And it's Calistius, Cetesias, in case anybody'd like to look it up. You're more than welcome to, because sometimes with Greek words, it sounds different than they're actually spelled. That's why I wanted to spell it. So this is what he wrote. They speak no language, but bark like dogs, and in this manner make themselves understood by one another. Their teeth are larger than those of a dog, their nails like those of these animals, but longer and rounder. They cannot be defeated in war. St. Augustine, excuse me, suggested that the dog-headed people descended from Adam. Other saints, including St. Andrew and St. Bartholomew, described these creatures as well as hound-like in appearance. And this is interesting, that their dog head disappears only after baptismal. So they became human at that point. Theologians have been debating for centuries whether these dog head people were real, had a soul, or could be taught the gospel. King Arthur, of legend, was said to have that he defeated a great army of dog men on the hills of Edinburgh. Medieval explorers also claimed to have witnessed the dog men. Writing in his travels, Marco Polo wrote that he encountered them on the Andaman Islands. And this is what he wrote. They have heads like dogs and teeth and eyes likewise. In fact, in the face, they are all just like big mastiff dogs. They have a quantity of spices, but they are a most cruel generation and eat anyone who is they can catch, if not of their own race. So this is a peculiar, I know it sounds bizarre, but I'm actually looking at a wood carving that dates back from the time of St. Christopher, in which he is depicted as a dog-headed being holding a cross who became a Christian. And it goes into the stuff about St. Christopher. There are many different origin stories for St. Christopher. However, one story places his origin in a battle between the Romans and a savage North African tribe called the Marginarini. This was around 300 AD. The tribe was renowned for being ferocious in battle, their cannibalistic tactics, and strangest of all, that they had the heads of dogs. During the battle, the Romans ultimately won. A giant beast of a man was captured, and he had a dog's head, and his name was Rehobus. While the legend takes many other forms from here, all agree that he was a great warrior, and Rehobus was converted to Christianity and changed his name to Christopher. After being a soldier of Christ for some time, he was martyred in Syria. There is no argument about this. And then he was eventually sanctified and became a saint. If you go into medieval Irish literature, you will find that Christopher's, this is a quote, this Christopher was one of the dog heads, a race that had the heads of dogs and ate human flesh. So multiple cultures describe them thus. And if you go all around the world, you will find stories of them from this time period, all of them describing them very, very similarly. And I thought this was fascinating because, like, we knew a little bit, we talked a little bit about the subject, but not a lot. And this is an amazing story and something that, I think it bears remembering. And now, does that mean that's what the dog men are? I have no clue if it has anything to do with that or not. But like serious explorers, Marco Polo, people like that, early Christian saints, all wrote about these people, and they wrote about them consistently describing them as hounds or mastiffs, which are fairly similar in look. It's a very odd thing to consider.
Yeah, so unless they died out, which we'll leave that up to our viewers and listeners to decide, but you'd think at that time, if there had been such a thing as social media, it would have been all over the place. It would have been very well known. So in today's world, either they don't exist, at least in the same numbers, or someone's doing a really good job of censoring.
Something's happening, but I mean, the fact is that I guess, like, if you would say paintings and wood carvings and things like this were kind of the only social media they had back then, you can easily find the records.
Right. There's, so if they were as prevalent today as they were, at that time,
they drove themselves underground in some way. I don't know, but I think it's a fascinating story, and it's the fact that there's so many different sources. I mean, in Irish lore, in, different lores from all around the world, different groups of people talked about encountering them and wrote in their journals about battles with them. So this isn't just an isolated piece of information. So we're going on now to World War II, to the Pacific Theater. American troops began to see what they called flying humanoids, and they reported them during World War II. So they are described as having large leathery wings like a bat. They were spotted around military installations multiple times. They moved silently. And eyewitnesses said when they appeared, not only were you frightened because of what you saw, I mean, that would just be really disconcerting, but you would have this feeling that this was an unearthly being that was watching you. There are several alleged sightings that took place around the Battle of Okinawa in 1945. And for years afterward, people, American soldiers stationed in the Pacific, still were reporting encounters with them. There's one that I wanted to feature, which is that of from St. Clair Tyler. He was a U.S. Air Force private on duty at a place called Camp Okobo near Kodo, Japan, and this would have been 1952, so well after they're at the end of all that, of the war and all that. So according to this, the private was on guard, and he heard a sound that caused him to pause. He thought it sounded like a giant bird, that of the wings moving, and he's looking for it, and as it's coming closer toward him, this sound. But at first he didn't see anything. This is what he would eventually describe. He said that this being, when it came into view, was about 7 feet tall, and it had a 7 foot or more wingspan. It flew closer to the private, stopped and kind of hovered, almost sounding like a hummingbird, like it could keep itself in midair. Panicked, Taylor got frightened, so he shot at the creature. He said it immediately vanished. There was no blood, no body, no anything. He didn't see it fly off. It just vanished. And his exact quote, there's a quote here from him. He says, when I looked to see if my bullets had found home, there was nothing there. It was just gone. Now, interestingly enough, Tyler might have been accused of tripping on something, but he wasn't the only person who saw it. When he went to report it, I mean, like, he had discharged his weapon. People were coming. He had to tell them why he shot. So his sergeant come running, and his sergeant and another guard all saw the same creature that year. In fact, two of them saw it that night. And Private St. Clair Taylor had no knowledge of any previous sightings. He had not had any contact with anybody, to the best of anybody's ability to tell, who had talked about this. And when his sighting was compared with somebody who had seen it previously and had been moved away from the area, so they had never had a chance to talk, it was virtually the same. Even more interesting is that other people started thinking that it was maybe a secret military project, a misidentification of wildlife. Like, there were all kinds of arguments, but there's nothing that has ever come to light to explain this. And this continued for many years, but just in that general area, nowhere else. And when the military presence died down, so did the sightings.
Very similar to stories you told about the gargoyles around airports.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and it also kind of reminded me of Mothman, you know, like it was curious about whatever was going on and interested enough to take a look. And so I thought it was a really interesting story. So it just boggled my brain. Now this next story is one of my favorites of the whole episode. So this is October of 1943. This is while the Germans were bombing London. So for those who don't know, during World War II, Germany took, one of their main combatants was the British, and they took great pleasure in bombing the crap out of London, hoping that they would just decimate the people and kill their will to continue this war. And so literally the entire city of London was bombed, and huge swaths of the city were laid to rubble. Many, many people died. Many were injured. In fact, because of all of this, they actually started sending their children to the United States to get them away from the death and the destruction that was going on. So this was a horrible time for these people. During that period of time, there was something, a group of people in London called the ARP. They were the Air Raid Precautions. And they were people who would volunteer to try to help. They'd run into the areas where the bombing was happening and try to help save people and help pull the rubble off of people and what have you. That was their job. And they just were doing the best they could to salvage what they could. And this is a story about a gentleman by the name of Howard Leland, who was one of those men and women who volunteered. You were literally armed with whatever weapon you could come up with and a flashlight. I can't imagine. But they had to figure out a way to fight back, and this was something they could do. So this was during the war. Like I said, it's middle of the night. There have been bombings going on all evening, all night, and it's really bad in the area that Leland's in. So he ducks into an abandoned, blown-up house. There's, you know, still standing, at least part of the structure still standing, and he goes into the basement area to try to get away from the debris as it's raining down in the upper part of the house, and he's standing down there. He's got nothing but his little helmet, his, you know, his sidearm if he had it. And we do know he had a flashlight. And while he's down there, he suddenly has this feeling that something else is there with him. And you know how like sometimes your hackles just go up? That's how it had to have been for Leland that night. And he turned and he could see something moving at the top of the stairs. So he took the risk and he flashed the light real quick. And this is what he said he saw. He said that he saw this monstrous creature, and it was this huge man-sized cat-like being, like it had a cat's head. And it was standing at the top of the steps looking down at him. And when his light hit the eyes of this beast, it glowed. It had horns protruding from its head. And he said it just exuded, and this is his own words from an interview, an aura of evil. And it was unblinking. And he said there was like this hypnotic quality to it, like he just froze and he couldn't break its gaze. And it launched itself off the steps downward at him. And he was completely frozen as if in a trance for a few seconds. And just as he realized he had to go sideways to let it get past him, he heard screaming of people talking. And the beast looked up, was just gone. It was right in front of him, ready to attack him. He could feel the heat of it. He could see it hulking in front of him. And then they heard people yelling, "Is there anyone down there?" And the beast was gone. And people came down the steps into the darkness. They were people like him trying to help find people that were wounded or whatever, and help drag them out. And he said, "Did you see it? Did you see it?" And they said, "What?" And he began to tell them what he had seen. To his absolute shock, a couple of them said, "Oh my God, other people have seen it around here too." You know, it was the neighborhood people that were, you know, trying to rescue other people that might have gotten trapped. And this haunted him so much that after the war was over, he made an appointment to visit a clairvoyant by the name of John Pendragon, who was very, very well known at the time. And Pendragon laid out a map and he said, "Don't tell me anything. I don't want to know anything, but you're going to talk about a place." And he put his finger on a little block and he said, "It's on this block right here." And the guy said, "Yes." And Pendragon gave him some information. And then with the information that Pendragon gave him, Leland began to do research on who owned that house at one time. And he came up with some interesting information. The person who had owned the house previously had been an occultist and a black magician. He had used cats as sacrifices in his rituals. The local people had been talking about it, abhorred what he was doing, and had wanted to get rid of him. They had put a lot of pressure on him, and eventually he hung himself at the top of those stairs where he saw that beast for the first time. Leland would come to believe that in some way that demonic spirit of that sorcerer who had destroyed all those cats had taken on a likeness of the beast he had murdered and had come out into the night because of the carnage and the blood and the destruction that was going on in the city of London and had made itself visible and was in some way attacking or attempting to cause more harm, and that he believed himself to have been very fortunate that other people interrupted what would have probably happened to him. And he said in the carnage of what was going on, who would have thought to say, "Oh, it was this cat beast that tore him apart." No, they would have said he was attacked by a dog or he was killed by the bombs or whatever. Now, this account, just so people know, came out of Pendragon's biography. Leland wrote about it and was interviewed about it a couple times in his life. And then I have a friend, Brad Steiger, who wrote a book called Bizarre Cats. And he actually dug up the interviews and shared them. So their, you know, primary source would have been Pendragon and Leland. But it's a fascinating story.
Agreed.
I mean, and I'd never... I thought I read most of Brad's books, but apparently I missed one because I'm going to have to go find this one now and see if I can find a copy of it somewhere to read. But it's a fascinating story, and it makes you wonder if during times of peril, wars and what have you, demonic entities don't come out and revel in all the destruction and the fear and the pain. And I've often wondered about that. Yeah, I think it would make sense too. I do. So I'm going to talk about another kind of entity that was seen during World War II. We've turned them into cute little cuddly critters that, you know, we make movies about, like gremlin. But the little beasts known as gremlins were not sweet little cuddly furry bits of stuff that, you know, jibber jabbered and what have you. These were actually taken quite seriously and mostly by pilots. They seem to attack aircrafts, and this is fascinating. So they are described most often by the pilots as gnome-like, but with reptilian features. So about the size of a little gnome, kind of that bulk, but reptilian-looking. There's an example of that that I thought was really illustrative of what some pilots claimed they had happened to them. So there's a story about a guy who's only ever described as by his initials, LW. He was flying a Boeing B-17 plane during the war, and he encountered these gremlins. He claims that these creatures were not just mischievous, that these things were evil, and that they attacked planes in mid-flight and caused them to crash. I know it sounds crazy, but there were many pilots who talked about it. A plane would be looked at, it would be perfectly running, everything checked out, and they would get into air, and then all of a sudden all kinds of craziness would ensue. And this is what he said happened. He said during one of his missions, he had suddenly had a lot of technical difficulties. He came face to face with a gremlin. He said it was 3 feet tall, with hairless gray skin, long pointy ears, and red eyes. This is what he says it happened in his own words. So I'm very aware of my surroundings, he means at the time this happened. And as I got higher, I noticed an unusual sound coming from the engine. The instrument suddenly went nuts. I look at my right and I see an entity staring at me. Then I look to the aircraft's nose and there's another one hanging in there. Dancing lizards. I was perfectly fine. My senses were in good shape, but the weird things were still there looking at me. They kept going at it, pounding on the plane with all their might. They appeared to be laughing with their big mouths open, looking at me, hitting the plane with their long arms, trying to pull stuff. I have no doubt in my mind that they were trying to crash the plane. I managed to stabilize my flight and I saw the critters falling off the aircraft. I don't know if they fell and died or if they jumped from my plane to a different one. I have no idea what happened. And there are a lot of reports from all over World War II about pilots speaking about this. This is, like I said, we turned it into a movie today and what have you, but these pilots described a demonic looking creature that was bent on destroying them. Interestingly enough, German and Japanese pilots would also see them and describe them. And at first they thought they were something that the Americans and the Allies had come up with. And we thought the same thing about them, much like the Foo Fighters and stuff. They all thought it was something else until after the war is over and they begin to talk and they all realize they saw the same things. And if you think they stopped at the end of World War II, well, they did not. They were reported in Vietnam. They've been reported in Korea. Anytime there's a military conflict, again, coming back to that theme of, do these things get drawn into enjoying the destruction and the pain and the fear, so they just continue to help make it happen? It's insane. Lon Strickler is a gentleman who runs a site called Phantoms and Monsters. And he had a gentleman that wrote a piece for him, or that he interviewed for a piece. And this next story comes from him. This would have been during the Vietnam War that this event happened. This was about 1970. The gentleman was an army corporal and he was second in command of a squad of soldiers in the DMZ, which is a demilitarized zone. And according to them, they thought, as they were moving through the brush, and you have to remember this was tropical, so there's a ton of foliage and what have you, and they were on a night patrol, and they began to see hearing things crashing in the woods around them in the foliage, and they would see things moving, but they couldn't tell what it was. So their first thought was Viet Cong, because frankly, that was their nightmare. And they start following whatever this thing is, and it's, they're going through this little valley, and then all of a sudden they hit this is what they describe it as a sheer wall of stone, oddly looking as if someone had stacked enormous boulders in front of it. And out of it, they see a cave entrance. Well, now the Viet Cong were well known for their tunnels and their using caves and anything like that to their advantage. So as they approach, they are very cautious. Because if it's somebody inside that cave, they can blow the cave up and save themselves. Frankly, that's what they're worried about. I mean, all the other stuff falls away whenever it's just you're going to die. And all you really want to do is not die. So they start to get one of them advances towards the cave. Others are watching what's going on so that they can shoot if something comes out of the cave. And they start smelling what they smell as a sulfur smell, and almost like a rotting body. And it gets stronger and stronger, and it seems to be coming out of the cave, coming at them, the smell. It's so bad that they're physically getting sick, vomiting, and trying not to, because they got to keep an eye on this. They don't know what's in there. And they take up positions behind trees, watching, you know, waiting for this thing. And they decide to wait till morning. We're just going to sit here and wait. We're not going to let anything come out of it. Come morning, we'll look. But we got a better shot in the daylight. So they go till morning. And this is whenever what happens, happens. Just about dawn, they begin to notice motion in front of the cave. This is a quote. A being I first thought was a man moved through the entrance into the clearing in front of the cave. It stood up from a crouch, and it stood at least 7 feet tall, and started to look in our direction. At that time, another similar creature was moving out of the cave. They were making a hellish hissing sound and looked directly at where we were at. The only way I can describe these beings is they were like upright lizards. Scaly, shiny skin, very dark, almost black, snake-like faces with forward-set eyes that were very large. They had arms and legs like a human, but scaly skin that, and I didn't notice a tail. I thought they wore long, one-piece dark green robes along with a dark cap-like covering on their heads. I didn't notice their feet. No one gave an order. It just seemed like the entire squad opened fire at once. Every piece of vegetation between us and them was sheared away. I yelled for a ceasefire. At the same time, I was looking in the direction of the cave, and there was nothing there. We immediately checked our flank in case these things had circled around us, but there was nothing. We approached ready to resume action and decided that these beings had to escape back into the cave. That's the only place they could have gone. And he talks about they left the area immediately. They talked about what had happened. They decided that they were not going to tell anybody about the incident, and they kept quiet until many, many years later when this one guy told his story. And if you know me, I like lizard people stories. So that was a really interesting story to me.
And you know, with caves, and yeah, that goes hand in hand with your other reptilian kind of stories too.
I mean, yeah, there's an awful lot of under the earth kind of stories with reptilian people. It's just a really recurring event to hear these stories, and I'm absolutely fascinated with them. And there's just so many of them. And I'm going to end on this next story, because I think it is just the most, is a really interesting story. And this one is a little different. So this isn't a war story, but it is a military base story. And this was during the Cold War, the 1980s. And this was the Hahn Air Force Base in Moorbach, Germany. You're familiar?
Moorbach, yeah, I've been there. Many times, yeah.
Oh, okay, well, then this story ought to be of special interest to you, mm-hmm. Okay? According to the story, there were the soldiers at the base began to see a strange wolf-like creature prowling around on two legs, spotted at night multiple times. Now, this started in the early 80s, and this would continue through, and the story I'm about to tell supposedly happened in 1988. So one night, a group of Air Force personnel were on the base when the sirens began to shriek into the dark, indicating something had tripped one of the alarms. And the base personnel went to investigate, and this is what they say they came across. They came across a beast that was a bipedal wolf-like monstrosity standing 8 to 9 feet tall, which gazed menacingly at the soldiers before clearing a 10-foot fence with ease. Tracker dogs were brought out, and the dogs were so overwhelmed with fear that they cowered and refused to move forward. No one knew what they had seen, but there was a whole group of soldiers who saw this. Now, later on, talking to some of the townspeople, this following story was uncovered. During the Napoleonic Age, there was supposedly a story of a man by the name of Johann the Baptist Schwitzer, and that's what it was always called. And he had deserted the army, Napoleon's army, and fled into this area, to this little German town outside of where this Air Force Base now stood, where he murdered the family of a farmer who had had the land and took whatever he could of theirs to continue, you know, living. The legend says that before he killed the farmer's wife, this man was cursed by the wife of the man, the farmer, before he murdered her, that he was a beast and he would always be a beast, and he would howl at the moon and he would not prosper. Supposedly, the soldier killed her as she was cursing him. And it is believed that the curse worked, that he became a beast, and that at the full of the moon, he would murder and rape and pillage in his wolf-like state. And the legend spread. He was caught and he was killed by a lynch mob of villagers during one of his rampages. It is believed by some of them, by some of the soldiers, that perhaps because he had been a soldier and he had run away, he had come to explore where the new soldiers were and what their purpose was in being there. And that is why he came to the base that night. And by the way, it was a full moon that night, just for the record. And with that, I'm going to wish everybody a wonderful night. If you like those stories, I have literally dozens and dozens more. So good night.
Fudge. Only I didn't say fudge.
Yes, you did.
Here, that's for the blooper reel.